The Geeking Basketball Podcast. My name is Ben. Welcome back to another episode. And we are, what, like 4 weeks away from the play-in tournament, the end of the regular season. Stuff is happening. I cannot believe we're finally getting to the end of this season. And before we do anything today, Cody, before we do anything, we asked the Thinking Basketball, as you like to call them, the intelligentsia. We asked the Discord community that we have at Thinking Basketball for our Patreon subscribers, patreon.com/thinkingbasketball. And they are nice enough to contribute the hive mind of sort of what's going on based on consuming our content and following the season, following the league throughout the season and whatnot. We asked them today, right now, middle of March, who do you think is going to win the NBA championship? How do you handicap the power rankings for winning the NBA championship? And 94% of the possible vote share went to the Denver Nuggets. They were in the first position.
Wow.
91% went to the Celtics. And if you look at the actual championship picks, two-thirds went to the Celtics. Two-thirds went to the Nuggets. One-third went to the Celtics. And then we had like one Clippers vote. There was one believer in the Clippers. That was the top three.
Wait, so everybody, except for that one Clippers vote, basically everybody thought that either the Celtics or the Nuggets are going to win the championship.
Exactly. Okay. They made it a two-horse race. Then the Clippers. Then the Bucks. Hmm. The Thunder. The Timberwolves were the next three teams.
Interesting.
Then the Suns. And then kind of a bit of a drop-off, down to about 10% of the vote share. So, like, scattered around some ballots getting, I think we did fifth place. I can't remember how far out we did. Sixth place votes, seventh place votes, something like that. Cleveland Cavaliers.
Hmm.
Cleveland Cavaliers are in there. Keep going down. 76ers, Lakers, Heat, Knicks, Mavericks. All the way down at 14, New Orleans Pelicans.
Huh.
Yeah. Yeah. Warriors 15, Sacramento Kings 16. You have any thoughts on that?
Wow. I mean, I would be shocked. I guess that's interesting because I think last time we were talking about like percentage of teams, like if I'd be shocked if a team won at all. Mm-hmm. And I think like Cavaliers, Pelicans, I would be pretty shocked if either of them won. So I'm pretty interested to see why the Cavaliers would be.
The title or a playoff series?
Well, the title. Ben.
Oh, okay. All right. Okay.
The title. I feel like I would need to see it tiered out. I would like to see what the Discord would say for the tiering because Pelicans being that low, that seems kind of mean. Like, I don't know if they should be 15 on that list.
14.
And I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't think they should be 14 either. I don't know what they should be, but if I say like 9 versus 14, like, am I quibbling that much? I don't know if they're all in the same tier, though.
I'll tier based on the vote share. Nuggets, okay. Celtics are tier 1.
Yep.
Clippers, Bucks, Thunder are tier 2.
I quibble.
You could say you could say the Timberwolves and Suns are kind of maybe in like a tier 3.
Mm.
And then there are a bunch of teams that have like between 5 and 10% of the vote share, and that's Cavs, 76ers, Lakers, Heat, Knicks, Mavericks.
Okay.
Yeah.
And the Pelicans are not in that.
Pelicans,
group.
Warriors, Kings are in their own scraggler tier. Scraggler? Mm. Is that the right word?
With a T?
Yeah,
a good old straggler.
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah.
Didn't I feel sound like Pelicans right should probably it. Pelicans should be in that group. I don't know what to think about the 76ers. Also, the Suns should probably be bumped down into the next group. I'm in such a holding pattern with Phoenix. I don't know about you, but every time I watch, I'm like, all right, I need to come back and check in when they have it figured out. And that's 50 games later. I'm like, all right, I need to come back in and check it out when they have it figured out. But I mean, they just might be lumped in at this point with like the Lakers and the Warriors in terms of like 36 plus year old star who's an incredible scorer, but maybe it's just time to you know, they were get out of there.
Okay, I want to talk about this. This has been on my mind lately. We've batted it around. I think it's time to go there. And I want to talk about Cleveland. I want to talk about New Orleans. There might be other teams we could talk about, but let's just start what you just said about Phoenix. Let's just start with them. I am really interested, of course, in fit and how players fit together and how players' skill sets travel and how they scale and all this stuff. And it's a subtle thing sometimes and it's a big thing other times. And when you have this experiment in Phoenix, The idea is Devin Booker and Brad Beal and Kevin Durant, they can all shoot, they can all play off the ball, they can all play on the ball a little bit. So on offense, you would think that you have some nice synergies. This experiment shouldn't really be that bumpy of a problem. But then I think about how coaching influences what we think of fit, how coaching influences how you optimize fit, right? So in this case, what kind of sets are you running for these three players? What kind of offensive philosophy do you have for these three players? And even what kind of personnel do you put out there with them? If you don't have a lot of secondary personnel that we know the Suns don't have, how are you trying to fill up the other two positions on the court when Beal and Booker and Durant play? How are you filling up the other three positions when you stagger them and you say, let's have two of them out there at a given time when one of them has to rest? And I'll open the floor up to you on those big thoughts, but I will just say with Phoenix, I have not seen, both from the secondary players and from the primary players, I have not seen enough to really say, like, there's some alchemy here that's creating a great offense that's better than the sum of its parts. They're doing things that have the skill sets fit together and complement each other in a way that makes them very difficult to guard. I actually think relative to 2024 offenses, they're almost easy to guard. And sometimes their skill just does the rest. You get a Booker or a Beal or a Durant isolation touch. Durant can shoot over anybody. Booker's pretty good at getting to a spot after a couple dribbles and releasing. Even Beal can do that. But harnessing them together, I haven't entirely seen that yet. And I think that's one of the reasons why I don't need any more time on Phoenix. If I had any Phoenix stock, I'm selling it. Let's put it that way.
Wow. Okay. Well, let me tell you one thing that I think is really interesting. Because when Kevin Durant, Bradley Beal, and Devin Booker are on the court together,
yes,
554 minutes.
Yes, what are they?
126 offensive rating.
That's a great number, right?
That's a great offensive
rating. What's the net
number?
Rating?
Plus eight. They're plus eight when those three are on.
That's
a good number, yeah, right? And so I guess, you know, we don't know if they're going to be healthy through the whole thing, but let's assume, just going forward right now, that they're going to be healthy during this run in the playoffs. And so let's go to a couple of the other reasons that you might be nervous about them. So let me ask you three reasons. You can, like, rank them in terms of how you're feeling about the Suns right now. So number one, do you just not think that the synergy between these three guys or the skill level of these three guys are such that they're going to synergize to a special level? Two, that the supporting cast just isn't going to hold up in a playoff setting? Or three, that the coaching isn't going to set them up in sets that's going to allow them to synergize like they should be?
Okay,
rank
so
those.
Yes, I have to rank those. Am I ranking them based on how much each chips away at their championship equity? Is that what we're ranking?
Yeah, yes, exactly.
Yeah, okay. Boy, it's interesting to think about how to tackle this, but I will say, number one, this is reminding me of the great start, sit, cut section. Yes.
I hate those games so much.
Yeah. So, okay. I think I will go number one with the role players, because I think when you get down to brass tacks later in the playoffs, I just still don't see, like, it's nice that they've gotten a few players that can play there. They've gotten good minutes out of Grayson Allen. I'm still very nervous about Nurkic as you progress through the playoffs into higher level competition in later rounds. And then even someone like Royce O'Neal is another warm body that can play in those situations. So I think they've done an okay job after this Beal move in this season of, like, getting a few players that can contribute at that level. But It's still not very good, Cody. It lacks depth, and I think it lacks quality, and to a certain degree, it lacks, like, great diversity and fit. I'm not sure you wouldn't be better off with, like, a really good defender who could maybe rim run on offense. I'm just not sure how much I love what the secondary players bring. So I'll put them first. I think I want to go coaching second. And obviously it sparked this tangent and this thought that we're talking about right now. But for me, like, Frank Vogel has been a very good defensive coach in the past. Phoenix runs for 2024 what I would consider fairly vanilla X's and O's. And the, I don't know, the offense just doesn't, it just doesn't feel like it puts a ton of pressure on defenses all the time. And it's like, yes, the three of them out there together are good. Phoenix is a good team. They're not a, they're not the 20th best team in the league. They're a good team. They've got this talent with these three great players out there. And as you said, their offensive rating when they're all out there, smaller sample, and we're not adjusting for opponent and anything like that. But it is, it's 126, 127. As I look at that, of course, they're shooting 43% from threes in that, in those minutes. So it's like, are they going to be able to sustain that? I don't know, but it's good. That's the point. It's good. But to be great, I feel like you want to watch when those three are out there and they're putting forth their primary actions, like they're playing their best hands. You want to just go like, ah, wow, this is really hard to defend. Ah, they're putting a lot of pressure on you in different ways. If you lean toward Booker, you get more Beal. If you lean toward the ball, you get more off ball. Durant's going to cut on the 45 cut from the wing, and he's really big, and then he can make an extra pass. You can go small, small pick and roll, and then you have to make decisions. But I don't see any of that with them, basically. That's what I'm getting at. And so to me, that's a... and who's criticized for it in Los Angeles as well, sort of a lack of maybe creativity with the offensive X's and O's on that side. So coaching is extremely difficult to judge, but that's, I think, how I would rank it from what I see. Yeah. Every year, people ask me about working in basketball professionally or even how we add people to the Thinking Basketball team. And Sports Business Classroom is one of my go-to answers. And let me tell you why. It's professional, hands-on teaching from industry leaders and experts that sets you up to work in basketball. Alumni have gone on to work for multiple NBA teams, major media outlets like The Athletic, Clutch Sports, and more. This year's new lead instructor is ESPN's Bobby Marks, and the curriculum covers scouting, analytics, media, and the salary cap. The program is a six-day immersive experience that takes place July 14th to 20th in Las Vegas during Summer League. And for a limited time, use the code THINKINGBASKETBALL for $600 off early bird registration. Interest is at an all-time high right now, and there are only 125 spots in the program, so you currently use Thinking Basketball at sign-up for $600 off that early bird price if you're interested at sportsbusinessclassroom.com.
Speaking to the role players, I do think this is a move. Obviously, it's a great move to get somebody like Kevin Durant, and if you're trying to build like this offensive base, you probably can't go wrong if you have Booker, Beal, and Durant all on the same team. But in terms of the way that they traded away other players and draft picks and things like that, it's kind of a move that kicks the building the role players like down the street just a little bit, right? Kicking it down the road where you're like, okay, we're going to get this base and then we're going to kind of build up. I think a lot of, like most other teams, kind of build up all of these role players and they're like, gee, we're the 2019 Raptors. Wouldn't it be nice if Kawhi Leonard landed in our lap? And then they do, and they're set up perfectly to have a championship run. This is teams built the opposite way, where they kind of need a year or two to gather all of the other pieces that would fit well with them. But then the issue is the age, especially of like Kevin Durant and then the health of Bradley Beal. And we don't really know how many more years they have together at like a really high level. So I think that's an interesting, like building this plane as we're flying it sort of thing that the Suns are doing, right? And so that's my response when it comes to the role players. But let me ask you a bigger philosophical question about fit here. When you're talking about players that fit well together, what do you mean when two players actually fit well? Like, do two players fit well together when they're just able to retain all of their value or when they're on the court together? Or do you want to see players fitting well together where they actually promote what one or both of them, or in this case, all three of them, are able to do when they're out on the court together?
Yeah, it's more of that last one. But we have to be careful because I think the better you get, the more oxygen you demand, the more you have the ball, the broader your skill set is, the higher your impact is and all that stuff, the harder to some degree it is to just automatically have that impact in different places. Meaning if you can take a league average offense and make them a top five offense, it's probably more likely that one team you'd be a top five offense, the second team you can make a top five offense, but you might run into a third team where you join them and they already have players that took them to a top five offense, and now you don't see that same jump that you used to see. I've talked about this extensively over the years. The short of it is, it's harder to take a 60-win team and move them to 70 wins than it is to take a 30-win team and move them to 40 wins. So in that like non-linear sense, Cody, really good players, I just want to see them maintain value. But yeah, I think the spirit is you're looking for something that harmonizes, that sings, where you say, hey, the best of this player is fitting with the best of this player. Jokic and Murray in the pick and roll. Like, it's just bringing out the best of both of them. The numbers are extraordinary. The things you can do with your lineup are extraordinary. And go back to what I just said about Phoenix. Like, you just feel the pressure of how to defend that. And it's, you know, if you paired Murray with some totally different type of screener, would you see all that stuff in his game that's so valuable come out? I don't think so. And it's the same, as great as Jokic is, when he has a guard that's less potent, when Murray was injured in the prior couple years, the offense is still good. He still does his magic, but you can't get those back and forth synergies, because at the end of the day, basketball is about finding the weak spot in the defense and forcing the defense to make decisions at the team level to say, hey, if I want to take away your scoring, you're going to beat me with passing. If I'm gonna bring three defenders to stop your two-man game, you better figure out how to use the other three offensive players on the court. That's what I'm looking for when I say someone fits well together. And just to put a bow on it, like, the flip side is you get a lot of stars that play together and they play pretty well, but the difference between like where the team is with one star and where the team is with two stars, or two stars versus three stars, is not that great. And we would call that more of an average or poor fit, I think.
And I don't know if this is outside of scope, so you can rein me back in if you don't want to talk about this right now. But when I also think about the Suns and I think about players that are fitting, there's almost two sets of criteria we're going with, and that's the offensive and defensive criteria, right? And offensively, you can look at it and try and figure out if they have some kind of synergizing fit or if they're even able to retain value with their fit. But if we look at the defensive side of it with these three guys together, Kevin Durant, he can block some shots sometimes by the rim. I think he's a fine enough defender back there. I don't think he's going to be able to hold up as like the five if Nurkic is on the bench, right? Like, I think they need more consistent big minutes. Devin Booker is a fine defender, but again, not somebody that you're going to like transform a defense with. Bradley Beal has struggled, I think, in the past. I think it would be interesting to see him in a playoff scenario again to see how he's able to ramp up the defense and if he's able to bring it up. But I think my point is, with these three guys, you're not getting, there's like really no chance of getting a synergistic defensive impact, right? And so if we just look at the offensive part of it, if that's really not clicking, you kind of need to build the defense around some of the deficiencies these other guys have. So, sure, they have a great fit, but I think it kind of misses a huge part of the point when you don't look at the other side of the ball, because, you know, that's a huge part of the net rating. And when we get into the playoffs, that might be the part of them that's easier to scheme against, because none of those three guys are going to blow up any kind of offensive scheme that comes at them. So, for me, for the Suns, that's like the sneaky fourth thing I'm most concerned about, is just the defensive fit of the three guys surrounded by their role players.
Well, I think that's part of it. I mean, I care about the overall result. If you cheat offense successfully, that's great. If you cheat defense successfully, that's great. But you know, if we look at a team and they put five offensive players out there and they, what do you say, 126 offensive rating, and they look good together, but it's like the defense is 118 or 119. Oh, okay. I care about the overall. I care about the net product. So, for instance, in the last month with the Suns, like, you look at their best players, they've all played nine games together, Bradley Beal, Devin Booker, whatever, and the lineups when they're on the court are like -3. So this is not great for this kind of year. It's not a great number in general. And even if the offenses are, you know, good, if you looked at the offensive rating and you were like, oh, that's great. In this case, the offensive rating is okay. Brad Beal's offensive rating is 120. In the last month, but that's my point. Like, the defensive rating is 122. That means so that means I care about the overall result. And to your point, defense is part of this concept of fit and synergy. And it goes back to what I was saying about the coaching, because you want to put a lineup out there that optimizes the overall five-man unit, not just the offense or the defense. And the stars you're building around and their skills relate to that. We were looking at I can't remember who sent it to us the other day, but someone sent us a clip about the Thunder and how they were countering some team's defensive strategy of putting the center on Josh Giddey. You know, we've talked about this before. Teams are like, Josh Giddey, we're going to ignore him. We're going to treat him differently. He's your weak link in the offense. So we're going to put our center on Josh Giddey. And Oklahoma City has Josh Giddey bring the ball up the court and sort of initiate from the top like he is a big man center playing out of delay, you know, quote unquote delay action at the top of the court. And what that means is they sent Chet Holmgren down into the corner to come off a pin down like he's Reggie Miller, because there's not a center on Chet Holmgren anymore. And so now you have to decide, like, are you going to get posted up off that curl by Chet Holmgren? Are you going to switch? Are you worried about Chet Holmgren popping out for three? And the whole point of the story is that they're able to do all of that. They're able to move Giddey to that part of the court, change his role, have Chet attack a different type of defender, because Holmgren can do everything I just said. He can flare out for the three. He can curl and go. He can attack a switch off the mismatch and post up. And on that play, I think he curled and dribbled and got into the paint and got his own offensive rebound or something and scored over everyone, because he's bigger than everyone, because the actual center is out on the perimeter guarding Josh Giddey. That's how the skill sets unlock fit with the role players. That's the kind of stuff I'm thinking of.
And I think this is why I've heard the discourse a little bit about how the Thunder kind of screwed up and didn't get a big man. They're like, they need to get some size before the playoffs. They need to play somebody that's going to be a bruiser, that can take on somebody like Jokic, things like that when the playoffs start. But I think that, like, that completely misinterprets how the Thunder play basketball. Like, having somebody like Chet, who's able to do those sort of versatile things, unlocks everything else they're doing. It's not like Chet's like fitting into all this other stuff. It's like, okay, because Chet is out here, we can do these other things. And I think the point with Phoenix is, like, the way that they unlock each other is Devin Booker has the ball, and if you send two to him, it's like, great, we'll swing it to Kevin Durant and we're gonna have to scramble to him because he's a really good scorer. But it's not necessarily like when the Suns are playing offense, they're like, oh no, Devin Booker and Kevin Durant are out here, they're gonna do all of this kind of witchcraft that's gonna be unstoppable. It's like, no, it's basically the same thing. It's just when they swing the ball around again, it's Kevin Durant that's catching it on the weak side instead of somebody else, right? It's not like the Nikola Jokic and Jamal Murray thing where, you know, anytime they run a late game pick and roll, everyone just goes to Jokic and Murray gets a wide open mid-ranger, right? That didn't work for them against the Mavericks, but, like, it works in pretty much every other situation. Unbelievable shot by Kyrie Irving, by the way. That's besides the point. But that's what I'm seeing with the Suns is there's not really a change in their offensive scheme when they're all out there, unless I'm completely wet. Like, are you seeing something else from them when they have their personnel out there?
No, but I want to go back to what you started with, where you send two to Devin Booker or Kevin Durant and they swing the ball, and even just that skill right there is a difference maker when you're talking about synergizing with other players who are in this situation going to have off-ball responsibilities and off-ball talent to unlock the two that go to the ball. So specifically, I put on the Suns and the Cavs the other day, okay? Mm-hmm. And this game was close throughout the game, and it went down the stretch, and I think Phoenix held on and won by 5 or 10 points at the very end of the game. But throughout the game, and especially in these situations you're talking about, the Phoenix big three is out on the court, and they'll run like a pick-and-roll action or a handoff action. Booker gets the ball. Two defenders go to Booker, okay? Cody, the number of, like, adventure passes out of that situation, tipped balls, turnovers, going the other way, three-on-ones for the Cavs, it's a lot. And I've talked about this in doing some deep dive pieces on him before. Like, one thing Kevin Durant struggled with in 2009 that he still struggles with in 2014 is these soft arm passes under pressure. When you put two guys on him and he's passing, he kind of just gives you this little, like, one-handed, like he's gently throwing a grapefruit across the room at someone. And those balls get tipped, deflected, picked off, or the pass is just slower to get there. It's not that insane LeBron James skip fastball, that Luka Doncic, I'm over here on one side of the court, I'm going to sling it to the opposite corner in like half a second or whatever, you know, whatever those things travel at, like 60 or 70 miles an hour. I don't know. I'm not a radar guy. I don't have a radar gun at home. Are you a big radar guy? You have a radar guy that hooks you up with radar?
I'm just thinking about, like, baseball pitches. I feel like 70 miles per hour of a basketball being thrown would be ridiculous.
That's very fast.
I genuinely want to know. How fast is a basketball actually traveling when LeBron throws a skip pass?
I'm assuming, like, a skip pass is, like, 60 miles an hour. I don't know.
Okay. Do you remember the sports science segments that SportsCenter used to run?
John Burgess, right?
This is one of those, right? We don't need, like, we got the Jordan Farmar jumping stuff. I think there's like a James White jumping sort of thing. We need to see how fast these skip passes are actually going in terms of like a pitch speed.
They probably did this. Someone should check. I think they did this anyway. That's the point, though, right? Like, there is a difference between a 45 mile an hour skip and a six. Now we're just making up numbers, like we're doing baseball scouting. Like he's got a nice changeup, comes in with a slider at 92. Do they even throw sliders anymore? I don't know. So the whole point is, even just the immediate little skill of like passing out of two on the ball can downstream affect the way the other skills fit with that, right? Like, how are you going to attack the closeout? How are you going to catch and shoot? Or what second side action are you going to get into based on the swing pass? If the pass out of the double is like a high loping pass to the other side of the court, the defense can recover and you reset, and then you just get into the same thing. Or in Phoenix's case, they're all so brilliant. They can all just score against the clock and make threes. And I mean, they're really good, but we're talking about the difference between being good and great. Being good in a sense that, like, you might not make it very far in the West, and like, you could win the West. Because what are the Suns, Cody? I think they're the seventh seed, right? Mm-hmm. Last time I checked, that's play-in city. You're in that play-in tournament. You're not sitting around waiting. You're in the play-in tournament. You might not even make the playoffs. That's the difference in what we're talking about right now.
Yeah, so when they're on the court, they're good enough. They have the skill sets that allows them to not really encroach on each other's skill sets, right? Like, they can all sort of do what they're used to doing. Obviously, they're not going to have the same volume or the same whatever else in terms of the amount of scoring that they have. But they all can basically promote what they're doing without taking away from one another, just because they're all good shooters. They can attack off the bounce and stuff like that. But what we're talking about, like you said, is that synergistic bumping each other up to the next step. Can I move on to another duo that I want to hear? If you think, if they land in the Phoenix Sun zone of maybe coexisting instead of like promoting each other, this has been a team of interest for a very long time. I was not on the episode when you were able to deep dive them, but I want to know what you think about the pairing of Donovan Mitchell and Darius Garland.
Yeah. Yeah. What, can we just do the whole Cavs? I mean, we're not going to deep dive the Cavs again, but I mean, just in the context of this conversation, the Cavs are yet another team. That's why I mentioned them. I think the Discord had them 14th or whatever we talked about a second ago. But or did they have them 9th and they had the Pelicans 14th? Okay.
Cavs are higher,
I almost think of it the other way personally. But there's another team with a bunch of talent. In this case, four players that have kind of been earmarked for being high-level players in this league. Jared Allen, Donovan Mitchell, that's the duo you asked. Oh, you know, you asked about Garland and Mitchell, right?
Yeah, Garland and Mitchell.
And then we also have Evan Mobley as well. And frankly, they even brought in Caris LeVert, who's like another skilled offensive player. So this isn't a situation of just like these four guys and absolutely no one anymore. So, okay. How do we figure this team out? What's going on with this? They win like 17 out of 18 games. We deep dive them. Some of their players come back. They've played under 500 since then. Although, to be fair, I believe a lot of the bumpiness and the losses have been without Mitchell, because he's been injured now for a bunch of games. And so you can like tune in and watch these different versions of the Cavs. You can watch the other night, I think you and I watched the Garland-Allen Cavs, and they've played teams like the Rockets recently. They played... Did I say they were playing the Suns? That we already talked about that game. I think it was the Suns before
that.
Yeah. So, like, you can watch that version of the team. Then you can watch the Donovan Mitchell Allen version that was cooking the month before that. Then there are these games where all four of them are out there. The takeaway for me is, like, I don't know if Garland and Mitchell fit together in the backcourt, and we can talk about why. And I don't think Mobley and Allen fit together in the front court, and we can talk about why. And so the whole thing is a smorgasbord of basketball chaos. You're like, what? Are they just better with two of these players? What is going on? How good are they in general? Is it a situation where if you took like Garland and Mobley and they just had a team built around them, they would be pretty good, but they lack skills as secondary players. So when you slide Garland and Mobley in next to Allen and Mitchell, you get this like redundancy, and you don't get anything much better than what you'd get if they were out there on all alone. I don't know. What do you think?
Okay, I'm going to start actually with Allen and Mobley. I know I started this whole thing with Mitchell and Garland, but I think...
That's what I'm saying. You could go into so many different combinations here that are just vexing. I feel like Commodus. I'm vexed. I'm terribly vexed.
But when you watch them operate with just Jared Allen, because I swear, Ben, I don't know if I've ever seen Evan Mobley play a game of basketball. I feel like every time I tune in, he's just out, right? Every single time.
I put the game on, the Suns game on the other day, and Mobley was out there, but it was his brother. His brother was playing instead.
So the thing with Jared Allen is they're able to spread the floor a lot more, like when it's just him out there. They have a lot more shooting when it's not the other Mobley that's out there with him. And Jared Allen's really a developed pick and roll player. I think he's really impressed me. I know we do a lot of like Jared Allen used to be like the, no, not used to be. I would say he's like the light version of Rudy Gobert in the Midwest. But in terms of offense, I think he's so much more developed than what Rudy Gobert brings. I think he's a much better passer. I think he's shown off a nice little driving game, a patient, like, I'm going to attack this closeout. He can shoot a jump shot once in a while. He's really good at catching low and kind of like, all right, I'm going to wait a second. Oh, little hook shot. Going to knock that in. And he's able to do all that. Because he has so much more space to operate down there, because Evan Mobley's skill set as somebody that's like, you know, a good enough secondary passer, not somebody that's going to blow you away, but a good enough passer, but he's not going to be spacing the floor. And when Jared Allen has the ball, Evan Mobley's just kind of like, all right, I'm going to go over here. I can't go in the corner. Maybe I'll go to the dunker spot. So Allen's really able to flourish in those situations. So in terms of like the two big men, I don't ever want to like say, oh, we need to trade one of these guys. But I do wonder when I see them how you can optimize having two big men that need to operate in like that sort of the paint. Like at least Garland and Mitchell, there's a lot more space to drive and outside the three-point line. But when you have two guys that operate in the same sort of like pick and roll, short roll sort of area without either of them being a legit spacer, I'm throwing my hands up, Ben, because I don't know what you're supposed to do about those two.
Here's what I've decided. Let's start with the backcourt.
Okay.
It's like two similar teams, the Spider-Man meme, looking in the mirror that then just became the same team. It was like you could have had like a Garland Mobley team and like a Mitchell Allen team, and you'd have a small little jitterbug guard who's a combo guard who can do all kinds of things, and this big man, and they could have played each other in a playoff series. It would have been super fun. And then we just said, no, let's make them one team. Let's just jam them together and make them one team, because Garland and Mitchell, when they're out there, the size on defense is an obvious problem. We've talked about that since the beginning of time. Mm-hmm. But I'm also seeing the size on offense, because if you are running a possession through Garland, like the other day, you know, I throw the game on, Garland, Allen, pick and roll, near side of the court. On the far wing, Donovan Mitchell's spotting up. Now, that's great in theory, because he's a great shooter. We've talked about this before. It's like super underrated as a shooter, so you don't want to leave him. He can provide a little gravity. You can swing it to him. He can finish the play. And, of course, he's skilled enough that if you swing it to him and you have an advantage, he can knife into the lane and use his driving skills. So it sounds great. But if Garland's my little teeny guard and he's running the pick and roll and he's going to make the play with the ball, what happens if I can get a guy on that wing who can cut behind someone with his size and throw down a thunder dunk, or cut, collapse the defense, draw extra defenders, open up a skip to the corner, or cut an offensive rebound and put it back with his size? None of those things are really things that Mitchell does a lot, because he's so small. So in the actual possession I watched that had this thought going through my head that triggered it, he literally sat there with his hands out like a catcher waiting for the entire possession. He was just like, I'm open. He's like, I'm ready for the swing. He was like in an athletic position and everything. It was so heartwarming. He was just like, give me the ball. I'm ready. Give me the ball. And the ball never comes. And so, okay, on one hand you go, that's fine. You just didn't pass it to him on that possession. He's still a great shooter. He still has value there. And I think that's true. But on the other hand, Cody, like, I'm trying to think of the things you don't see when you watch a game. And then you turn on other teams that are super successful at stressing people, and you realize, like, oh boy, even when someone like Herb Jones cuts in that position, like, that's a little bit of an extra wrinkle you're throwing at the defense. When you watch the Thunder, we talked about them. The Thunder are probably out on the edge of cutting edge X's and O's this season in terms of the stuff they're doing. Just moving mid-sized players through the paint, back out to the perimeter, back down to the dunker spot. They can offensive rebound from there. It's hard to do that when you have two small guards. So even on offense, not only are they taking away possessions from each other when they have the ball, but the theory of like how they fit off ball. Garland is even, Mitchell can slice in and throw down an offensive rebound because he's such a great athlete. Garland gets even more lost away from the ball. He tries to run you through a few screens sometimes, but it doesn't have that same punch to stress defenses physically. You know, he's not battling and running around like Steph Curry. It misses those components to me.
And as somebody that's participated in a fair amount of all-time draft sorts of hypotheticals, it does feel like the conversation about fit and what kinds of players would go really well next to other high-end players is basically boiled down to what's their three-point percentage. Because I think some people might be listening to this and confused. They're like, well, wait a second. If somebody, like, let's talk about the play you were just talking about, right? Donovan Mitchell's over on this side. Doesn't that drag his defender away and give Darius Garland some driving space? And then even if the defender comes to help on Garland and Garland kicks to Mitchell, Mitchell's an incredible driver, right? And then the player has to close out and Mitchell just has so much more space to drive. Like, Ben, what are you talking about? That's a great fit. But everything else you talked about illustrates the other issues because it's a holistic thing you have to analyze. In this particular thing, yes, the shooting ability does help the fit. Yes, the driving ability does help the fit. But then there's all of these other things over here that they're not bringing to the table that's so much more hard to analyze because you can't look at it and be like, oh, he didn't do this well. It's like the analysis of absence, Ben. It's tough to analyze that which is not there initially. And so I think that's the aspect of it. You can't just look at one part of the fit. You have to try and look at all the parts of the fit and think about what other players might be able to bring if they had a different skill set.
So you have passing, you have three-point shooting that you mentioned, there's also cutting, there's offensive rebounding. I talked about movement without the ball and the difference between just like running a route and being okay at running that route and also stressing a team as you run that route, being really physical as you come through screens or shedding your defender as you run that route as he tries to stick to you and trail. Then there's the endurance and the creativity. Like, are you running a route and then making a read and realizing like, oh, my guy with the ball is doing one thing. I want to do something else. The Pelicans, one of the Pelicans' favorite plays, and I think we'll get to them in a second because this is really interesting, is Zion Williamson dribbling at the top of the key. And then you get a shooter like Trey Murphy III flying out of the corner up to the top to set a screen. But Cody, of course, he's not going to set that screen. He's going to ghost that screen like he's playing Mario. You're just not going to see him. He's going to go right by. He's going to get another screen, a flare screen, as he goes to the far side of the court. So he's coming from one side of the three-point line essentially to the other. And Zion can loop the little pass over that screen to Murphy for a three-point shot. They love that play. That play is synergistic because what happens with Murphy and what happens with Zion go together. If Murphy is in a position where as he slips that screen, the defense slides and tilts towards him, Zion crossover, hit the hole, drive hard. If the defense stays because Murphy's about to set the screen and they're like, oh, are we going to switch? Are we going to do? We got to create a wall against Zion. We can't let Zion drive downhill. Now you lose Murphy for a second. And so the size, like go back to what I said, I'm talking about moving a route, but also setting screens. These guards that can shoot, if you're stationary, yes, you get the value of stationary three-point shooting and gravity. But moving isn't just about movement in terms of like tugging people in your wake. Movement is also about, are you going to stop and set a screen? Steph Curry is an incredible screener, right? They use CJ McCollum in New Orleans as a screener, getting small guards that can move around. I mean, I don't mean to do this to you on the spot, but I mean, isn't there a criticism that it would be nice in Milwaukee if Dame Lillard set more screens, right? Like that ability to just move and set picks. And then as you put those skills together in 2024 with the way basketball is played, with the complexity of the offenses, the brilliance of the offenses, and all these actions working together, as you stack those together, then reading the game on those plays. And when you tune into like a Golden State, that's what you see with the magic of like Draymond and Steph and back when they had Iguodala. And like that, it was all synergizing because everything was read and react. And you put all those skills, you put the movement, you put the screening, you put the shooting, you put the passing, you put the cutting, you put it all together in one play. That's great fit.
Again, I love that you brought up Trey Murphy here. Trey Murphy.
I like that's what you took from that fever dream rant I got on.
Yeah. I'm building up to something here with Trey Murphy, though, because you've talked about this a fair amount in the past in terms of like the importance of role players on championship teams. Like, obviously, we put a lot of stock in how good the top players on a specific team are. In the same way, we might actually put too much stock in how the top players synergize with each other. Because this play you just described with Trey Murphy, with somebody like CJ McCollum, how do the role players synergize with the top players? Like, what sorts of skill sets are they bringing to the table that's going to allow them to help promote themselves and the guys that are next to them? I mean, going all the way back to our Phoenix Suns guy, I don't know if people can remember that so long ago, but when we were talking about the Phoenix Suns 20 minutes ago, how much synergy are some of those guys bringing to the table? I know Grayson Allen is shooting the lights out this year. Like, obviously, that brings some level of skill for them, but they don't necessarily have these big-time second-side attackers that can cut and make these sorts of plays. They don't have these big men that can go down there. And, you know, Nurkic can throw a pass that's nice once in a while, but he's not going to be, like, a great hub for an offense. He's not going to be the defensive organizer that the team needs. So I think that's what you have to think about. Again, like, Trey Murphy, do you have guys like that that are going to be able to do that? Zion, not a great defender. I think he's improved steadily throughout the season. But then how do you help that? You just have this frenetic bench of defenders that are never... You have Najee Marshall running at people. You have Jose Alvarado running at people, right? You have Larry Nance Jr., who, you know, maybe not like a super high motor, but a really high IQ defensive sort of player. And then that all kind of synergizes to allow Zion do what he's going to be doing best. So that's what I really like about the Pelicans, and I don't know if we're transitioning to them now, but that fever dream of a rant just kind of sprung to mind to me that's like, oh, we need to be talking about how role players fit well with the star players that are out there.
Yeah, of course. It all fits together. I mean, that's what a general manager is trying to do. That's what coaches are trying to do when they balance lineups like this and sort of try to find the alchemy that last year we talked about the classic move of just like taking a Quentin Grimes level player off the bench and just throwing him in the starting lineup and just changing the chemistry just a little. It's like Vicky Cristina Barcelona. You just need a little salt. You just need the triple action to just properly take play. Have you not seen Vicky Cristina Barcelona?
I don't know what just happened.
Okay, sorry. Yeah,
is it a movie? Is it a movie? TV show?
Sorry, I got to rewind. Okay, let's edit that out. We'll just start the whole section over. Yeah, it's like Cody. It's like cooking. It's like cooking and needing to balance your acid and your fat. How about that? Yeah.
Well, I cooking.
That's what the role player star thing is like. They're both important.
It's the Duncan Robinson Bam Adebayo sort of chemistry that's out there, where you have somebody that can run around to something and say, oh, you got really excited about that.
Because I think this is why Robert Horry is such a great player, right? Mm. Because on one hand, when you talk about stars fitting together, the fact that certain stars can carry such massive impact, you can put a team like Curry and Durant together and have arguably the greatest team or greatest offense of all time. That's really important. Like, when your stars are redundant versus your stars fitting together, that's really, really important because those are the massive drivers of value. And it's really hard. We're talking about the Suns. We know the Suns are good. We're talking about the Cavs. We know the Cavs are good. We'll get to the Pelicans, it sounds like. We know they're good. But, like, 50 wins in the NBA usually doesn't mean much historically. But 60 wins, that's a ton. And to get there, even look at the coaching thing, because you asked me earlier to rank the importance. Look at what we talked about earlier in the year with Nick Nurse in Philadelphia and changing the way they kind of run the offense in Philadelphia through Embiid and how that unlocks Tyrese Maxey a little bit, how it helps the slashing of Kelly Oubre and maybe Tobias Harris. Well, I don't know what's going to go on with Harris lately, but like you see what I'm getting at? There's so much there from the star perspective that it drives impact. But also, if you've got 2-3 role players in that lineup, if you're Robert Horry in that lineup, what was Robert Horry really good at? He was a versatile defender. He was a stretch big man in a league that didn't have a lot of stretch big men. He also understood when and how to cut. And because he's a big dude, whether he's playing next to Hakeem when he's young or Shaq in Los Angeles, he's a big guy. He can get down the lane and throw it down when you hit him on the cut because he's like 6'9", 6'10". And he's a great extra passer. So he's not the one creating the offense. He's the one continuing the advantage once Shaq or Kobe or Hakeem or whoever. How many Hall of Famers did he play with? Tim Duncan. Who's creating the advantage for Robert Horry? That would be a fun game. It's like, whose line is it anyway, but who's creating the advantage for Bob? You see what I'm getting at? Like, having multiple of those players is the thing that starts to get you toward the beautiful game Spurs, where your sum is, the result is always greater than the sum of the parts. And in general, I think we focus on stars for good reason because they drive so much of the impact. But you, what you're saying about the role players is exactly true, and it's exactly why the lineups with Trey Murphy, I think in New Orleans, like Zion and Ingram, not so good. We can talk about why. Zion and Trey Murphy, very good. Ingram and Trey Murphy, very good.
I'm gonna talk about Boston for like 1 second. 1 second. Because I'm going to make a quick defense for Tatum and Brown as a duo. That's been the discourse for years. It's like these two guys don't necessarily mesh. Like when you see them out there, they're not necessarily a synergistic duo that's helping each other too much out there. But the way that they actually are synergistic is they allow the players around them to be high level in all of these other skills without taking away what they do, right? Because if you have Tatum and Brown out there, you're probably solid on scoring. Like other guys that you put around them, you don't need somebody that's going to need the ball to put the ball in the basket. They're not ideal. They're not the best ever, but they can get you some baskets. Number two, you have two guys that are flexible defenders. Okay. Brown has more warts defensively than Tatum. Tatum, we've always talked about as, you know, being a top tier nail defender, being a very flexible defender, being a solid weak side rim protector. But when you have those two guys out there, you sort of have a great base to throw in other kinds of defenders that can sort of do all these other things. And I know the rest of their starting lineup is unpopular now with all-star and sub-all-stars, but I think that's the point with those two, is that they have these skill sets that allow these other kinds of players to go out there and promote exactly what they're doing, because they don't have to worry about like the big things that Brown and Tatum are doing. So I think that's my defense of those two.
Yeah, and I think that goes back to what I was saying about Chet earlier. Mm-hmm. It's versatility at a high level. So Are you gonna build a team around Tatum and Brown and actually get great scoring? Maybe. Are you gonna get a great offense around them? Nah, probably not really, right? But that's like the weakness. Everything else is, oh, okay, actually, so you can play these guys at the forwards, you can play them at the 2-3, you can go big, you can go small, you can put a guard like Kemba Walker out there, or get like a more on-ball juice-heavy offensive driver, or you can go Drew Holiday, Marcus Smart, and you can just get an unbelievable defense and then have them help sort of act as a ballast on the offense to create and sort of supplant the playmaking and extra passing and things like that. 3-and-D. Derek White is yet like another example of that. I don't know if the average fan, I don't know how to take the pulse of the average fan anymore, Cody, but I sometimes worry that the average fan these days doesn't realize how much pick and roll Derek White runs in like certain situations, like reset, second side, come down really early. Boston just is in the flow. Boom, quick pick and roll action, because White doesn't put up huge numbers. He's not this like sexy scorer off those actions like Luka Doncic or other small guards in the league. But he's another one of these guys that can sort of support and fill in Tatum and Brown in that role. And yet, what happens every year in Boston? What's the big takeaway? They're at the top of the league. All of the criticisms about these guys, basically every year they've been healthy and play together, they've been at or near the top of the league. And of course, in the last few years, as they've gotten into their mid-20s, I mean, Tatum has been around forever. What is going on? How many playoff games has Jason Tatum played? This is ridiculous. We had that in the Thunder video, the stat that in his rookie year, Tatum played more minutes than the entire Thunder roster has played in the playoffs combined prior to the Gordon Hayward trade. And even after the Gordon Hayward trade, it might not change that much because Gordon Hayward doesn't have a ton of playoff minutes as well. But the takeaway is that they're always very good.
Yeah. And if we go back to the Pelicans now, these are two good players. Zion, I don't know, man. You go back and you watch him now. He looks fantastic. He's incredible at finishing. You get him like an empty-sided isolation. He drives in and scores. You see Brandon Ingram. There's a pick and roll. He sets somebody up. He's slinging a pass. He goes into his pull-up game. Maybe hits a three-point shot, right? Everything looks all good and gravy. But then you think about it. You stop and you're watching the Pelicans, Ben, and you think, well, wait a second. Were they ever like involved with each other when they were on the court? Or is everything they're doing just kind of like in their own little silo? And I think the numbers bear it. I don't know, I have it off the top of my head, but I'm pretty sure that, well, first of all, there's the weirdness with the Pelicans bench just being like, when both of them are on the bench, they're just incredible. And I don't know what to make of that. But what I do know what to make of is the fact that the Pelicans seem to be a lot better when Ingram's on the court without Zion, and when Zion's on the court without Ingram. When they're together, not quite. You're not seeing this interaction effect right now, and I think the film bears that out. I don't know about you, but I'm not seeing all these great plays where it's like, wow, Zion's roll gravity over here is opening up so much for Brandon Ingram to drive in and attack. So while I think both of these are nice players, I enjoy watching them, I'm not seeing the same connective tissue between them.
There does seem to be sort of two offenses in New Orleans, and I think that's maybe that's a good place to wrap the discussion of fit, because it takes us full circle to these teams that are on the, you know, sort of radar for playoff teams. Can they make a run? Where should we put them? Intuitively, I think at this point, I might have New Orleans ahead of the other teams we've talked about today. Is that crazy? Is that a hot take? I mean, they're ahead of them in the standings.
Ahead of the Suns and ahead of the Cavaliers.
Yes, exactly.
I'm nervous about the Cavaliers. I don't know what to make of them. I think Donovan Mitchell is a fantastic player.
Mm-hmm.
The Suns, I still don't know. I'm still bowing out.
Who would you pick in a playoff series between New Orleans and Phoenix?
Wow. I think I might pick New Orleans.
Yeah, it's tough.
I think my reason for doing that is this: just their like lineup of defensive guys they can throw all over the place. I mean, you want to talk about, if you're an ISO-heavy sort of offense, right, and you don't have a ton of this sort of synergy where you go out there and it's like, this is an unstoppable play, the Pelicans are probably the last team you want to play. It's like, oh, Herb Jones is on me? Great, I'll get a switch. Okay, so Trey Murphy the third's on me now. Great, I'll get a switch. Okay, Najee Marshall's on me. Like, it's just a lot of length and just tenacity that's coming at you from a lot of different ways. So I think just from that side of it is probably why I'd take the Pelicans.
Yeah, it's tough because at the same time, New Orleans is one of these teams with a ton of talent. You mentioned, let's just start here, okay? And remind me to read some lineup data, even if we have to do it after the outro. I love the fact that some people don't know we have a little mini podcast after the outro. because I mentioned the two different offenses, and you said, well, their bench is killing people. But is that the bench, or is that CJ McCollum playing with the bench? Because I know they had a stretch last month, maybe I have lost track of time, I think it was before the All-Star break, where there were some guys that were injured and maybe Zion was still getting back into shape or whatever. But the point is, CJ was out there with the bench for a while, and CJ might have been playing the best offensive basketball of his career, just kind of like commanding that role and picking up that extra load that he had to carry. And as you just said, there's a lot of talent on this team, even in the secondary position. So Trey Murphy the third is the most glaring example, but Jonas Valanciunas is a skilled offensive player. But then you also have these sort of like defensive dudes, from Jose Alvarado to Dyson Daniels to Larry Nance Jr., who's a pretty good versatile body. So you take CJ, you put him with those lineups, and is it truly the bench that's killing people, or is it him? Do you have the numbers?
So it's only 300 minutes, Ben.
This is 300 minutes with CJ or without CJ?
When McCollum, Ingram, and Zion are off.
All sitting down. Yeah, what is it?
They're plus 10.
Yeah. So maybe 10. Their bench unit's just killing other bench units. I don't know. But that's a great place to start, because they have all this talent in these peripheral positions. And then you get to, okay, what about Zion? What about Brandon Ingram? It's tricky with Zion because he was out of shape at the beginning of the year. I still don't think this is the peak Zion, but he's clearly in better shape than he was earlier in the season. There's more pop. The finishing is starting to come back a little bit. And so you look at the last month, I want to say off the top of my head, they're like plus 8 with him on the floor in the last month. But I still think you see, correct me if I'm wrong, I still think you see like a similar signal where you're like, why does it look one way with Zion, another way with Ingram, and then you put them together and it just doesn't look like what you'd expect? And that's what we think of when we think of bad fit.
Yeah, exactly. They're like a plus 2 or something like that, which, you know, it's fine enough. But when you have two guys that are supposed to be like your stars, and if you didn't have this bench that's just mobbing people like they're the Knicks babies, you know, I don't know. The Pelicans might not be in.
What are they?
So the Pelicans kind of remind me of the Knicks of the West, right? Because they just have this like defensive tenacity.
I see.
And, like, the bench for the Knicks just come out there and they're just attacking people all over the place. It's the Knicks thing.
Yeah. I thought someone named Nick had some like very, very violent babies or something. You said they were attacking people like Knicks.
Some
babies.
Knicks. I could see why that would be the case.
Yeah.
That'd be a really strange sentence to bring up. Violent Knick babies.
I don't know. You've had some good segues before. I mean, I think we're still getting mileage off the bison gravy. So
yeah. I think it was venison.
It was venison. Sorry, I've upgraded it to bison in my head. Yeah, it was venison. So
can I ask you a big historical question?
Yeah.
Or do you want to talk about the Pelicans?
No, I just want to finish this point about the Pelicans. And yeah, can you remember your historical question? I don't want to lose it.
Oh yeah, for sure.
This is going to be great. Okay.
It could be like another hour, so we got to contain ourselves.
No, I just want to. All right, let me punctuate this point really quickly. Zion, point Zion offense, hunting screens with Zion, like against the Clippers last week, just like starting the second half. Hey, Ivica Zubac, how would you like to deal with our low pick and roll every time? And just like 3, 4, 5 straight buckets off that to start the half goes from a close game to like a 12-point game or something. So the Zion style of offense, it doesn't feel like Ingram has a great place for his skill set and how he's succeeded. But then on the flip side, when Ingram has the ball, maybe elbow touches and isolation and things like that, what do you do with Zion? We've talked about ways to make him more active off ball, but it's still, it just feels like almost two different offenses. It feels like when Zion goes to the bench, they can run a different style of offense, especially through Ingram. So I think that's a lot of what's happening in New Orleans. I don't know if there's an easy answer, but you know, that's another example, I think, of where things are clashing.
And I don't want to speak for you here, but I don't think that's saying that these teams are completely dead in the water because of it. Like, teams can coexist in these sorts of situations. You think back to the Rockets when they had James Harden and Chris Paul. That was definitely two offenses. I mean, it was the same offense. They just both ran it separately when they were out there.
At the same time, yeah.
At the same time. And, you know, look at them. They almost made it to the finals, and they might as well if they didn't miss 27 straight threes.
They were a great team. They're an absolutely great team. I think another historical example that's used a lot is the 1977 Philadelphia 76ers. To go way back, Julius Erving comes from the ABA, but you also have George McGinnis, who was like an MVP-level player in the ABA. And then you also have Doug Collins, the broadcaster and coach, who was like an all-star and kind of like a nasty, cool little play, like run around shooting a bunch of jumpers before the three-point line. And so you had this very talented team with multiple stars, and there was just this constant tension about how the stars didn't fit together and they wanted the ball, and they were up 2-0 in the NBA Finals. So you can have fit that isn't ideal and still be a great team, right? So now, you have a big historical question?
Well, I think even the Miami Heat with LeBron and Wade is a solid example. You just have such incredible basketball players. They encroached on each other a little bit. And, you know, LeBron was a good cutter and Wade was a good cutter. And in transition, they were unstoppable. But again, that was one of those things where you look at some of the data and you're like, yeah, is LeBron by himself just a better team than having Wade out there as well?
It's always worth mentioning this. When that move went through in free agency, and I've heard people be like, oh, you know, he was being hyperbolic. And no, it was he captured the zeitgeist of the time. He captured the way everyone felt. Jeff Van Gundy said the next morning, on like the first interview I think he did, they're going to win 75 games. And the reason he said that is because LeBron's Cavaliers won 60-plus games without Dwayne Wade and with Zydrunas Ilgauskas and these other players. Now, it turns out the other players were built over multiple years to maximize LeBron's singular heliocentric star force. Even down to Mo Williams making an all-star team, he's like a complimentary guard who can do some ball handling and can shoot, and then you want a bunch of 3-and-D players, and at the time, of course, the spacing was different and double bigs and all that. But when you got to Miami, it was like, oh wait a second, you're going to add Dwayne Wade, who can get the Heat to 45 or 50 wins by himself? You got LeBron with his Cavs at 60-plus wins. You have Chris Bosh, who's an all-star, and he's skilled, and all you got to do is put two other players out there that can it just approximate what happened in Cleveland. It didn't sound crazy at all for someone like Jeff Van Gundy to be like, yeah, they're going to win 75 games. And in fact, their regular season performance was worse than the Cavs without any of those other stars, than the LeBron Cavs from 2009 and 2010. So it's another example, Cody, of like, they definitely could have won the NBA Finals that year. But when we talk about great fit, that's kind of what we're talking about.
And this is the issue with Helio guys, is because when you try and think of like the ideal fit next to a Helio guy, there's really not great options. There really isn't a ton of great synergy unless you're talking about like a Steve Nash, Amari Stoudemire sort of thing. But when you talk about two wing players, it's tough to fit them next to each other unless you just have like, I don't know, Reggie Miller. But then even then, Reggie Miller's banking off a lot of movement, which Helio guys usually don't bring to the table. But when you think about like Trae Young and Luka Doncic, the thing that they don't have that LeBron has. LeBron is also special on offense. The thing they don't have is massive defensive impact. And LeBron is a really good fit on defense because he allows you to do all of these really interesting things when he's out there defensively while still kind of having the same warts that a Helio guy has. So I just think the idea of trying to fit a Helio puzzle into this conversation, I think that's sort of a pin in the whole topic as well.
Yeah, but we usually talk about it from that perspective. But the interesting thing about these teams today is like none of them are Helio. None of them are necessarily like these heavily on-ball redundant players that are clashing into each other. Even Jalen Brunson and Luka, and talking about what happened when one goes off the court and one stays off the on the court, this is a different thing. Everything we've talked about with these teams today, the Suns have more of these hybrid off-ball players, the Cavs and the Pelicans. I said, remind me to read these numbers from the Cavs because it just is befuddling. It just completely confuses me to no end. When Mitchell and Allen are out there, okay, they've played 700 minutes together. They have a plus 12 net rating. This is very good. Right? Yeah. This is what you're looking. This is what you're looking for, right? When all four of them are out there, they have a plus 4 net rating in 300 minutes. And you can kind of go through and you can start going through the combinations of like what works and what doesn't work. And you'll pull your hair out a little bit because it's hard to figure out what the heck the optimal pattern is. It's hard to figure out if they're actually better when all four of them are out there. I mean, I think it's a legit thing at this point. The redundancy is that strong because maybe a couple years ago, the shooting was a little different, but now you got two non-shooters. You got Mobley and Jared Allen. These lineups where you can take one of them off the court and replace that with a Dean Wade type of player who can at least stretch and shoot threes and defend and slash a little bit. I think it makes a big difference. I also tried to check for, all right, what's going on? Is it are these small samples just about three-point shooting? Is that all that's happening here? And the interesting thing is if you take the Cavs, big four, when they're all on the court, Mitchell, Allen, Garland, Mobley, in those 300 minutes, and you take the three-point shooting numbers, Cody, and you make them team average on shooting for the team, and you make them team average on shooting against the team, opponent three-point shooting, now all of a sudden they're plus 12. And so your instinct might be to say, well, is it just three-point shooting luck? To which I would suggest no, because the reason they're shooting so poorly is that Mobley and Mitchell are Mobley and Jared Allen are out there and they're losing that ability to like actually space the floor and get these clean shots. And I think instead of viewing this as luck in a small sample, I very much view it as this is the symptom. Like we're seeing the signal of the problem. The call is coming from inside the house, my friend.
Not only that, but then you also have the defensive inflexibility of having both Mitchell and Garland out there, right? Yeah. So it's the lack of spacing, but on the defensive end, you're not able to do all these other sorts of things. All right, let me ask a question here. I have a couple names in mind, but I just wanted to see what you were thinking. I'm thinking on both sides of the ball here, offensive and defensive. I'll use one of your terms. We can call them the most portable. Which players in NBA hit? Let me rephrase that. What stars in NBA history do you think are the most portable or are the easiest to have a synergistic effect with other star players out of any players in NBA history?
That's a really big one. What's going on? We just did the podcast. We did the whole pod. Are you just only getting warmed up right now?
I mean, I just thought it would be a quick little, let's talk about this.
You gotta be kidding me.
Let's name a couple of names.
No. I'm not even gonna touch this. This is an entire podcast. This is a third rail issue. If I just named a name,
I came up with three names.
I know what your three names are. I know what they are.
I don't know if you do. Maybe you do.
Yeah, I do. Okay. What's your criteria?
You can say the most portable, but also who has the potential for the most synergy on both offensive and defensive of any stars in NBA history.
Oh.
I came up with three on the spot. Came up with three on the spot.
You're doing offense and defense?
Offense and defense, Ben.
Okay, that's tricky. Mm-hmm. That's very tricky. Let's do it this way. Let me guess your three names.
I love this.
All right. Is one of your names Kevin Garnett?
Yeah, he's number one.
Okay.
Absolutely.
All right. That's why I feel like we should stop. I feel like I should get out. I should get out while I'm ahead. Offense and defense, number one was Kevin Garnett. Okay.
I hope you agree with the other two as much, because they're just the first three names that came to mind.
Well, when we were just talking about offense, I was going to suggest that you watch Nikola Jokic play in Denver. But then when you added the defense thing, it
yeah, exactly.
It changes exactly. things a little bit. Okay. Defense?
I'm going to add a fourth because you might say him. So I'm going to add a secret fourth just in case you say his name.
Secret fourth. I'm going to say, is it a player from the 90s?
Yes.
Is it Michael Jordan?
No.
Okay.
I think it is his teammate, though, Ben. It is his teammate.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's tough. It's tough because I think defensively, you've got your bases covered with Scotty. 100% have your bases covered. But he is a type of player that can enhance other offensive talent around him. But also, how great is he as an offensive player? Like, philosophically, do you want to answer this question with a guy who drives offense more and can give you the kind of versatility and flexibility that you were asking about in your criteria? That's why I was thinking Jordan over him, because Jordan's such an offensive force, and then you just build the offense around him. I don't know.
I guess Jordan would work too, because you can use him flexibly on defense as well. And I guess that's the tricky thing about this kind of question, is how you're trying to level it all. Because if you have Pippen out there, you can do anything on defense. Not just like his handling and passing ability.
That's true.
And yeah. I know he doesn't have like the spacing and stuff, but his transition attack, the spacing, he can grab some offensive rebounds. That's a lot of variability. You imagine Pippen next to Jokic?
Like, he needs that 1995 to 1997 3-point line. That like 22-foot line, the junior tees really helped Scotty with his jumper quite a bit, just like getting a couple extra percentage points out of that shot.
Can I give you a decade for the last one?
Okay, sure. I had a name, but give me a decade.
Say a name. Give me a name.
I was just wondering if you're going to throw Larry Bird in this conversation.
Larry Bird is my third one.
Yeah, okay.
As well. Absolutely. Those are the three names that came to mind.
Yeah.
And I didn't know if you were going to say Draymond, but I had Draymond as a secret fourth.
That's a secret fourth?
He's the secret fourth.
Yeah. Again, I don't know what you do offensively when your offensive impact is so much smaller than other guys. Like, I don't know. Jerry West is an interesting all-time name. I don't know.
I don't know what to do with guys like Jerry West, just because when you think about floor spacing, like Jerry West didn't play in an age when there was a lot of spot-up types of jumpers taken. Like, he was a lot of on-ball sort of creating juice. And I know he coexisted really well next to, like, Wilt and whatnot, but I don't know. And Gail Goodridge coexisted next to him, fair enough, but I don't know. I guess he probably would have been a good sharpshooter and a great little defender with his size and length.
I'm telling you, this is probably an entire other podcast. If you want to hear this as another podcast, let us know. Otherwise, check out patreon.com/thinkingbasketball. You can support us there. We have our player and stat board. I'm just thinking about these guys now, Cody. I'm thinking about the all-time portability dudes.
You nailed it, though. Like, I don't know. You hit Bird and Garnett pretty well, and you landed in the same team as Pippen.
Well, hold on. Let's put on our platonic caps for a second here. Okay. I did not necessarily nail the accurate answer. What I was confident in is that I could guess the three people that you had written down. That doesn't necessarily mean that that is the actual answer.
Oh, now I think we need to do a podcast on this. Now we need to do a podcast.
Thanks for listening all the way through on this one. And wherever you are, hope you're having a great day.